this week on Pop of Culture.
I did not know the floral industry, and a lot of people don't understand what goes on in a flower shop, what they do, you know. It's a big misconception that it's all beautiful and good smells, but it's extremely hard work and it's all last minute.
A Memorial Day tradition crafted in East Central Indiana. And later,
every market, I make between 100 and 150 pies.
We bake pie. We'll send baking smells through your speakers. Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
From Indiana Public Radio, you're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. It's Memorial Day weekend, and you know what that means. It's also Indy 500 weekend. When a driver wins the Indianapolis 500, they're handed two things, a glass of milk and the winner's wreath.
Since 1992, Julie Harmon Vance has made that wreath from her floral shop, Buck Creek in Bloom in Yorktown. She invited us to take a sneak peek.
Julie, first tell me about your history in all things plants and flowers. Tell me a little bit about your business.
Well, I started my business in 2007, but prior to that, I worked from 1988 on down in the Indianapolis area at flower shops.
What was the interest? Why flowers? Why flowers and plants?
I fell into flowers. I was an artist from birth. I mean, the creative mind, the Crayola kid, the art classes in high school.
Yeah. You know,
I did all kinds, anything artistic. My main goal was to move to Broad Ripple for, you know, excitement.
Yes.
And I did start college for art in Indianapolis right after high school. But I found a job in a floral department at Kroger Castleton, and I loved it. And then I had a couple older people kind of take me under their wing and teach me the business. I worked there shortly, and then I moved on to full-fledged flower shops. But after that, it was my medium.
Were you surprised that you could do so much with your desire to be creative within the realm of flower arranging?
Yeah, I did not know the floral industry, and a lot of people don't understand what goes on in a flower shop, what they do, you know. It's a big misconception that it's all beautiful and good smells, but it's extremely hard work, and it's all last minute. And you have to be a fast designer to be a successful designer. Most flower shops consider funeral work their bread and butter. But I've fallen into a lot of larger events in Flowers for Business.
One of those events is a really, really big event, Julie. I mean, probably the biggest this state has. Especially in the summer, in May. Of course, I'm talking about the Indy 500. Talk about your involvement with the big race.
Well, I am the designer for the last 33 years that creates the winner's wreath for the winner. And the wreath that I create is the most photographed flower arrangement in the world.
That's awesome. Just to hear you say that sentence, does that freak you out? I mean to let that sink in for a second. The most photographed flower arrangement in the world.
Yes, I would say so. Can you think of another?
Wow. I cannot.
I mean, there's the Kentucky Derby blanket and
yeah,
the wreath for the unknown soldier. But
no, it's the no. Yeah. Wow. Well, tell me how this arrangement came to be. Did they have some sort of application to do the wreath?
No,
was there a competition?
I got lucky, but I also feel like it was destiny. Mm-hmm. In a sense, I was 22 years old and working at a flower shop at Keystone at the Crossing. We had a great business there. I worked for a man and wife that are dear to me still, that were like my parents away from home when I moved.
Wow.
They owned the shop. Mm-hmm. So they went to church with a man that was working for BorgWarner. He was a litigator. And that year, Bill Cronin, that created the wreath for 32 years prior to me, the only other person that did, he passed away, and so Borg Werner was seeking a good florist, and you know, he said, "Hey, I know a great florist." Wow. So that's how we acquired the order, and I was the designer there. So the three of us, the three amigos here, we came up with how it looks now. And Dan actually handcrafted the letters for several years in the beginning. I do have them professionally cut out now. But when we put 33 orchids around the wreath, we thought that was so cool, and we mentioned it to Borg Werner.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, let's keep that. So before I made it, it did vary in the way that it looked. And
sure.
I'm sure that Bill was trying to figure out what the best way to go with it.
Yeah.
So I at least had all his years behind me when I started. I love it exactly how it is.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it. I think it's perfect.
Yeah, and so these, the letters that I'm looking at in the photo, first of all, in the shop, I have to point out that as soon as you walk in this beautiful shop, you see a wall of memories, of 500 memories with wreaths everywhere. And those are wood. Is that wood?
Yes,
wood
right
cut?
Behind you.
Yeah.
They're ready to go.
Oh my gosh.
The twins are ready.
That's awesome. So these are going to be the actual wood letters that are on the wreath this year.
Yes.
Very cool. Very
cool. I don't know for sure, but it might be the last time because Borg Werner has changed their logo recently. So something we're going to talk about after the race.
So it's going to may look a little different. So
it's possible.
Yeah. So how do you take this on every year, and what is your inspiration? When do you start thinking about it, and how does this unfold for the race each year?
Well, I'm constantly thinking about
yeah.
it, and it's been a constant challenge to keep the exact same materials in stock, because a lot of things they've discontinued. So if I catch wind of it, I'll buy a whole bunch.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
I'll figure, you know, I can make this many up until I'm 89. I'm good. I bought enough.
Yeah.
So I do. Like the polyurethane wreath was an issue.
Oh, yeah.
So I have case after case. This year, the ribbon was discontinued.
Wow.
So I did find it. Like the ribbon company sold it off, and I found it, and I bought as much as I could. So
wow, the black and white checkered ribbon.
Well,
is
no,
what
it's
you're
the red, white,
to,
and blue.
Or, oh, the red,
and
white,
it's like
blue
a French
one.
Wired ribbon.
Oh, okay.
And you start searching online, there's just nothing like it. So
oh wow, and go ahead.
As far as the flowers go,
yes.
My wholesalers are on board. They know, but we start talking a month or two ahead, and then the flowers came today. So they usually come
really?
About Tuesday. They're right there. And they're fabulous.
Those are gorgeous.
This year's from the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
And I was researching. It's a family-owned company, so I'm excited later to reach out and send them a picture, even if they knew, you know. Because they did go to a flower market first before, like, so they may not know where the orchids went to. So hopefully that'll be special to them.
So how are you tracking them down? How do you get
Well, the box had a lot of information.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and it's not in English, but I Googled this word.
Yeah.
And I found out this is a great big floral market interchange, and you can see like train loads of flowers where buyers sit and buy. So they probably don't know that's where they're headed.
Yeah.
So I would think as an orchid grower, that'd be a huge privilege, right?
Yeah. And so these are just a beautiful white with like really bright pops of yellow, and would
like
you say
burgundy,
that's fuchsia,
like a burgundy?
Yes,
center. That's what I'm shooting for. Always, sometimes it's not the case.
Yeah,
but I'm very happy with those. Now you'll see that one over there had like a pink middle.
Oh yeah,
but I mentioned earlier he had a pink car and a pink suit, and it looked really nice.
Oh yeah, that is nice.
It was a coincidence.
Absolutely. So, what do you know the name of this particular orchid? Like what this variety,
you know,
is
the variety,
other than beautiful?
Yeah. Variety name is Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. Okay. And so what made you decide on the Virginia orchid, like that for,
well, as I mentioned, for years I did the Fort Knox Angel Flight, and that company disappeared on me. They were 5 inches across, the stark white, and they had a nice burgundy center. So I'm constantly trying to find one that looks like that.
That's similar.
But it always depends on the growers and what they have available in their crop. And so it's kind of a battle of the countries right now who gets my order. So this year,
have you ever
Holland orchids.
Yeah. Have you ever had a year or season where it looked like,
that orchid's not going to be available?
Yes.
And then what do you do?
Right here. So that was the year I had three different country orchids in here, but there was a lot of bad, and my wholesalers were able to FedEx some from New Zealand, and I got them on like Thursday.
That was stressful.
So yeah.
Yeah, and what year was that? Because it said that tradition almost had to change this year.
2021.
When you were oh, my goodness. Oh my God. But it always comes through. It manages to come through, and they're
just
gorgeous.
Just like the weather on race day.
That's right. So when you are, how long does it take to put this together, start to finish? When do you, what day will you sit down?
Well, I'm
going to
start prepping today.
Okay.
I will fully make one Thursday and definitely make one Friday, because I have some documentation going on Friday from the museum at the Motor Speedway of the wreath being made.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And tell me about that. Why does the documentation happen?
Well, the museum's under a remodel. And when they open in 2025, they'll have a really nice display of all the contributions that Borg Warner has given to the race. And it includes the wreath.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So do you have any idea what else is going to be included from your...
Well, of course, the trophy will be centered. Yeah. And then I know the ring is involved in the milk. And, of course, the artist who creates the silver faces on the trophy.
Yeah, you're right up there with the things that people think of when you think of the... Other than the cars. But when you think about the iconic images...
Yes.
The wreath is always involved.
I love that. I love that image of him drinking that milk and it's... spraying everywhere.
Yeah.
That moment while it's perfect before it's smashed.
Yep. So what happens to the wreath after, like, we're looking at a photo right now of a driver who has the wreath after they want. What happens to the wreath after that?
I think the drivers really love that wreath.
They take it
home? I usually get a call right after the race asking how we can preserve it.
Oh my gosh.
If Penske wins, we have a little routine where I ship them silk orchids and they replace it in their dried greenery.
I love that idea.
So yeah, that one is special. I've heard, you know, they don't want a duplicate or, you know, it's got to be that one.
Wow.
And I have made silk versions for winning teams before.
Yeah.
But there again, you know, the nostalgia of that one is very important, I've heard.
Oh, I mean.
And I do know that the milk does a number on those letters.
So your advice would be maybe try not to get milk on the letters. Yeah. Yeah.
They should let me in there, please.
Yeah. Can I just cover that up? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What is the best part about doing what you do, Julie?
As far as a florist or as far as the winter's wreath?
Both. Let's start with as a florist and then we'll talk about the winter's wreath.
The best thing I do as a florist is... I really help a lot of people when they're trying to express themselves at important times, which a lot of times means my funeral work. I do a tremendous amount of casket sprays and stuff for family, and a lot of them are really specialized to what, you know, that person loved during their lifetime. And many times it's been a racing theme. Mm-hmm. I do get a lot of call-outs for people out of state that'll drive in and get a winter's wreath for a funeral because that person loved Indy 500 so much. Or a casket spray that has race flags in it and things like that.
Yeah. And then tell me the best part about being involved in the race in this way.
You know, anymore I feel such an attachment to the racetrack. It just feels like it's part of me now. And I just have such a sense of pride and such a sense of Indiana pride, you know.
Do you go to the race every year?
Yes, I do, thanks to Borg Warner. I have wonderful tickets and almond parking.
All right, fancy. That's awesome. How long do you see yourself doing the wreath?
Well, honestly, you know, I figure by 75, 78 years old, old hands may be stiff, but, and I might be an old has-been by then.
Oh, come on, how? Yeah, several decades left of doing the race.
I hope so, yes. And since the style never changes, I'm good.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about the wreath and about your passion for flowers and arranging and congratulations on your success.
I appreciate that.
And we'll see you at the race.
Yes.
Julie Harmon Vance is the florist at Buck Creek in Bloom in Yorktown. She's been making the Indianapolis 500 BorgWarner winner's wreath since 1992. As kids of all ages look for activities this summer, our own Phil Hoffman sat down with the person in charge of One Destination.
We're joined now by Kinda Rinker, who is the executive director at the Muncie Children's Museum. Thank you for joining us, Kinda.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So the Children's Museum has been a fixture here in the Muncie area for a very long time. Can you talk a little bit about the mission and the history of the Children's Museum?
Sure. So we are in our 47th year. In December, we'll turn 47. And the mission of the museum has always been to provide hands-on, interactive exhibits and programming for children of all ages in a safe environment. So that's what we try to do on a daily basis. We serve a pre-K through about a second or third grade audience. We offer daily programming at 11 and 3 every day, and we try to do different activities based on the time of year, season, that type of thing. We do different things at summer and those types of things. So we try to do that throughout the year. And then we also offer birthday parties, mainly on the weekends, but we do offer birthday parties to families and children. Currently, we over the past couple years, we have been raising money through our More to Explore campaign, and we are undertaking an opening of 5 new exhibits over the next several years. We just recently opened our new model train layout with the help of the Muncie and Western Railroad Club here in Muncie, and then also a new water table. And those were our two most popular exhibits, and they definitely needed a refresh. We've been open in this location for about 26 years, so they were well loved at this point. And so those were the first two. We currently are working on a new weather exhibit and a new nature area. And then our last exhibit will be a new construction zone. Each of these areas will have hands-on activities for children. There will be a literacy aspect to each exhibit, and then also career exploration, as well as other interactives that teach children about the various exhibits, for instance, the nature exhibit or the weather exhibit, and then the construction zone will teach about trades and careers. So
you know, when you hear the word museum, people might think of paintings on a wall or sculptures, and obviously that is not.
We are not that.
Right. That is not what you are after here. So what's a typical day like here at the museum? Can you walk us through the kind of things that families and kids will experience when they come here?
Sure. So I laugh because people say, well, what's a typical day? We don't really have a typical day because you just never know what will happen. But when the children come in, you know, depending on whether it's a field trip or they're visiting with their family, because it can be a little bit different of an experience. When they're visiting with their families, they come in, it's a free explore. They can kind of go to whatever exhibit they want at any time. So, you know, we usually say people spend about an hour and a half to 2 hours here in a visit. And in the past, a lot of times kids will, you know, travel from exhibit to exhibit and go from thing to thing. But with the opening of the new water table and the new train layout, we are finding that the kids are spending a lot of time at the water table, a lot of time at the train exhibit, and then, you know, visiting the other areas as well. But they're really liking these new exhibits. So that would be a typical day for a family. When a field trip comes in, that's a little bit different because obviously they are coming in. They may have a program that they have scheduled, so they'll do that type of thing. And then they'll kind of stick with their groups as they go around the museum. But it's always fun. And like I said, everything's hands-on and interactive for the kids so they can touch everything. And they can break some things from time to time, but we get it remedied and it's fine and we move on.
Well, anytime you're serving thousands of kids in the course of a year, you know, probably things are going to get broken at some point, right?
Correct.
And certainly the replacing of the exhibits after a few years, I'm sure that becomes very necessary as well. If you haven't been to the museum recently to see the changes, it's a pretty big, dramatic change in these exhibits, so you might want to make sure you take time to do that. So one of the other things about the Children's Museum that people may not know is that you do free weekends.
We do.
So can you talk a little bit about sort of how that works and the kind of things that people can experience when they come on a free weekend?
Sure. So the third Saturday of each month is open for free from 10 to 5. And we have done this for, I believe, at least 15 years. So it's been going on a long time. We just felt like that was a need in the community, and it continues to be a need. So that is something that we do. We try to offer special programming on those days, just different things. For instance, we have a health fair related thing coming up in June. We usually do a health fair related thing in January. In March, we do a literacy fair. And then, like I said, just different things throughout the year. Right.
So obviously, as a nonprofit, the Children's Museum serves the community. And a lot of these exhibits and updates, you had to rely on donors and supporters to do that. Can you talk about that process and sort of how you go about putting this all together and the players that were involved that helped out?
Sure. So there are two ways that we do money. That we obviously have an annual campaign that we do every year. You know, we rely on lots of donors, funders throughout the community, and everyone is very generous, and we are able to meet our operating goals every year. For these particular exhibits, for example, opening these new five exhibits, we had to do an actual capital campaign, because that when you're talking about replacing five new exhibits, it's a lot of money. And so our capital campaign was called More to Explore. It started, unfortunate timing for us was 2020, but we did raise a lot of money during that time, even though it was 2020. The goal of the campaign was $3 million, and a large portion of that was to go towards exhibits. So that takes a lot more effort, obviously, because it's, you know, you're raising hundreds of thousands of dollars versus, you know, maybe thousands of dollars every year. So we had to organize a committee. We have chairman, honorary chairman, people that go to bat with us and help us contact, you know, funders in the community, even funders outside of the community, because when you're talking about $3 million, you're looking at finding not just the people that are here every year. You've got right. to go and find other people.
Well, and of course, now you've got a couple exhibits that have been refreshed, and right. so that you can actually see the impact
right.
of what folks have come here to support. Obviously, with an exhibit, you know, you mentioned earlier you had some of the exhibits around for years and years. So the reason why they're so expensive to replace is because not only do they have to be safe mm-hmm. for kids to interact with, but boy, you think about thousands of kids banging on something
yes.
Over the years. I'm sure they find very inventive ways to.
They do. We always I've worked at the museum for over 25 years, so I have stopped myself from saying kids will never do this, because as soon as you say it, they find a way to do it. And it is funny, because there have been things that have happened, and I'm like, how in the world did that happen? But one of our board members at one point kind of made an analogy. You know, we have 35 to 40,000 visitors that come through this museum every year. So imagine 35,000 people coming through your house a year. It gets a lot of wear and tear and a lot of love. And so it does. There's a lot of upkeep and a lot of maintenance to keep everything going and keeping it fresh and up to date.
So obviously, Kinda, you know, folks, I'm sure many people are aware of where the museum is, but for those who haven't been here or don't know much about it, where do they find out more information? Tell us a little bit about the location. How do they get tickets? How do they make everything
sure.
happen?
Sure. So we are in downtown Muncie. We're at 515 South High Street. We are in the same building as the Horizon Convention Center. We have a lot of our information as far as programs that we offer and different camps and, you know, different activities that we offer on our website, which is MuncieMuseum.com. And then we also have a social media presence. So we have a Muncie Children's Museum Facebook page. We also have Instagram, Twitter, and we also do some TikTok. So all of our exhibits and information can be found on all of those sources. It is $7 per person, ages 1 to 100. For general admission. We also offer yearly memberships that can be purchased for $80 a year, and it gets you unlimited visits to our museum as well as museums around the country. So that's always a good option if you're a family that likes to visit museums a lot and check out different places. But all of our If you want to visit the museum, you can purchase tickets as you come in. When we have special events, special events like camps or that type of thing, or special events that we offer, a lot of those tickets can be purchased online through our Facebook page and our website.
Well, Kinda, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
And if you haven't visited the Muncie Children's Museum, make it now.
Yeah, we'd love to see you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was IPR's Phil Hoffman talking to Kinda Rinker, Executive Director of the Muncie Children's Museum. Everyone loves pie. But perhaps no one more than Susan Danner, known locally as the Pie Lady. Our producer, Luke Jones, and I visited her kitchen in Muncie to witness the pie-making magic.
We are here today with local culinary pie artist, Susan Danner. Susan is known throughout the region as the Pie Lady. It's nice to be with you here today, where it all happens, where the magic of the pie happens.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thanks for having us. I wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your ties to Muncie and your pie journey.
Well, my ties to Muncie go way back. I'm the eighth or ninth generation that's lived here in this area.
Whoa.
Even before it was Muncie. I haven't lived here always, but I always come back. As far as the Pie Lady, it started out that when and I retired back in 2008, my daughter Moth and I, we decided we needed to do something that was together.
Yeah.
So we had a friend that was in Hartford City, and they said, well, you know, we've got this market up here in Hartford City. Why don't you come and learn about it? So we did, and the gentleman there was so nice. So we thought, well, what can we take? Well, we bake, so we'll take some baked things. So we had a variety of things, cookies, some breads, just a variety of things. And people really seemed to enjoy food. So fine. So we decided that maybe we could do this in Muncie. So the fellow's name was Jim, and we talked with him, and he said, of course, I'll help you, you know, tell you what to do to get started and everything. So he did, and we started the market, and oh my, I can't even remember how many years ago it was, but it was the Muncie Makers Market, still is, and it, my booth kind of evolved. As I said, I started making cookies and little breads and small size pies and that type of thing. And the pies seemed to be what people wanted.
How many pie recipes do you have, or how many pies do you make with any regularity?
Every market, I make between 100 and 150 pies.
Wow.
And I'll brag a little, I sell out usually fairly fast.
What does that process look like? Because, I mean, we make one to two pies for, like, Thanksgiving or something. Talk about how you make 100 of them.
Well, okay. The ones I take to the market are 6-inch pies. So they're a small size pie. And we joke because people say, oh, well, I like that one and I like that one. Well, I'll just get them both. They're little.
Solution.
Yeah. How I start out, it takes me 2 full days. And what I do is, ahead of time, I make the pie crusts. And I know exactly how much it takes for a pie crust. So then I'll make that, I'll divide the pie crusts, and I freeze them. So then when it comes time to start the baking, I'll take a few out of the freezer at a time, and I'll roll them out.
So I'll roll it out. Maybe. Sometimes they roll out easier than others.
I do the one crust pies first, like the pecan, that kind of thing, because I can make those faster. So I get all the pie crusts made, And for the ones that are a double crust, I'll make the bottom crust, and then I roll out the top crust and whatever decoration I put on it, and I stack them up, and I put them in the refrigerator, so then I can pull out a few at a time, and then I start in, and I'm very, some say organized, some say nuts, but I have, okay, these bake at 350, these bake at 375, you know, whatever. And I can bake 8 small pies at a time.
So this one takes 2 eggs.
And it takes 2 days.
And you do them all in like a standard household oven?
Yeah, that's what everybody says. I'm like, well, I just have an oven. I don't know. It's a regular oven.
And it's going to take vanilla. And I make my own vanilla.
It smells fabulous.
Mm-hmm. It's really easy to do. You get the vanilla beans and vodka.
Oh.
That's what it is, yeah.
I have probably... I'm going to say maybe 50 or 60 different recipes, but not everybody. There are some that people really like, and there are some that I've got, like, one person likes this pie, mm-hmm. and somebody else wants only this pie.
Now, has this particular recipe developed over time, or?
It's my mother's recipe.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And she had made it for, you know, forever, and... I just pretty much stick with what she had.
It's very fascinating to find out what you're working on and what your ties are to Muncie. And we're here specifically to say, Wewo, what are you working on?
What am I working on? Well, I'm always looking for new recipes.
Okay.
And I take suggestions from customers, from friends, and they say, have you ever made this? Well, why don't we try that? It's interesting. It really is to find like, oh, wow, that's really good. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I make pecan pies. So I saw a recipe that said caramel pecan, and I thought, well, that sounds good. We'll try that. So I did that. Then I saw another recipe that says chocolate pecan. I'm like, oh, yeah.
And I also pre-measure the pecans. It saves so much time if stuff's pre-measured.
And a friend of mine said, well, you make caramel and you make chocolate pecan. Why don't you make it turtle pecan and combine everything? So I did. I found a recipe. Well, first I just experimented. And then I found an actual recipe and tried several different versions and had my friends act as guinea pigs. And they go, that isn't it. No, not yet. And finally they said, that's it. So I now have a turtle pecan pie, and that's been the latest one that I've developed.
I love that story of the art of pie making, the looking for the right chemistry. And
that's exactly what it is. People don't understand that baking is chemistry. And I was a science major at Ball State, and one of my degrees is in science, and I taught science, one of my careers. And I was a home ec minor and a science major, and people would look at me like, are you crazy?
Did you always know that your two majors were going to lead?
Never.
Pie making?
Never.
No.
Never. Never.
Didn't cross your mind?
No. Never in a million years.
Now this one's going to be a chocolate pecan. So we'll add a bunch of chocolate to it.
And it's just chunks of chocolate.
Just chunks of chocolate, uh-huh. And this one, it's already overflowing.
Everything is carefully measured, but the chocolate is measured by love.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the best.
And then,
just a regular old oven.
Now, where is it that we could contact you to get a pie order and have a discussion about pies?
Well, I am on Facebook as the Pie Lady. And I get a lot of people that way, or I'm also on Facebook as Susan Danner. So either way, or they, people message me, they text me, whatever. They find a way. Or they can come to the market and we can talk there. So.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Where are you going to be available next for people to see you and your lovely array of
it
pies?
It is on Thursday, June the 6th, I believe is the 6th. And that's when we'll be at First Thursday, okay. Right there on the corner of Adams and Walnut.
Okay.
I always say across from the black glass building.
Nice. Thank you again so much for this and talking to us and spending a little time with us today.
I'm glad to. Thank you.
Susan Danner, known professionally as the Pie Lady.
Can I get some pie during the break? Did you bring some back or what?
We've got some. Okay. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. And it's time for an earworm. All right, for our regular segment, What Are You Working On? We already know what this person's been working on, and we want all the details. Let's welcome back Mikey Mason, comedian, musician, all-around awesome guy. Mikey, thanks for coming back.
Yay!
In.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And if you listen to episode 9 of Pop of Culture, if you haven't listened to it, pause this right now, go listen to it, and then come back.
Seriously, Mikey don't. Said, I was there. You really shouldn't.
Yes, you should. Mikey, we asked Mikey if he would write a Pop of Culture theme song.
Yeah.
And he did. So, Mikey, talk a little bit about the process. How did you go about developing the theme song for the show?
Well, writing a theme song is fundamentally different than writing... It's both the same and different than writing. I mean, another song. It's mm-hmm. just you're dealing with format and structure, and it's you're constrained by time a lot mm-hmm. of times. I tried to come in under 30 seconds. I think I hit 34 seconds. I came up with the hook in the morning. I woke up one morning and I was, you hear the pop pop pop. Culture,
yeah,
and you know that's E minor CB, but I heard that distinctly in my head, and I was like, but it's got to have more energy, and so I'm playing around, and I came up with that second part because my other thing about writing was that I wanted a song that was recognizably a Mikey song, and I deal with strong hooks, and
yes.
I think Pop of Culture was a fairly strong hook,
mm-hmm.
And I knew that it needed the title in there. Because why would you write a theme song for yourself? Well, personally, I mean, it needs to be a little on the nose.
Yes.
With this, especially with a title like Pop of Culture.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I write guitar-driven songs, generally acoustic and acoustic rock guitar-driven songs with pop hooks and pop melodies and soaring high energetic parts. And I'm very melody-focused. And I wanted it to have an energy because I want it to represent the kind of the vibrance and energy of arts scenes
yes.
in communities mm-hmm. And the kind of life that they bring to a community. So that was you know, all in my head. And then I just started paring it down because I'm like, this is too long. Doing most art is editing. I mean, there's a whole lot of, what is it they said about sculpting? It's you take a block of marble and you cut everything away that doesn't look like it's supposed to. It's all editing. So you put down as much as you can, and then you start taking away what doesn't need to be there. And I think I did okay for a 30-second song.
Oh.
I think I did all right.
More than okay. Yeah, I was going to say... what's left for the listeners is a really great theme song. I'm trying to remember when I sent it to Luke, our producer, and he immediately responded. He was like,
this is so fun, 17 exclamation points, right? And I think that is, you know, exactly what you want for this type of program. I think it absolutely represents the energy and the fun that we're having on this show, while also through the lyrics talking about the different ways that people create and the different ways we look at arts and culture. And yeah. I think it's wonderful. It is a great theme song, and we cannot thank you enough. Did you want to talk about the lyrics a little bit and what you?
what I find interesting is I did not read the show description until after, because I posted the song on my Patreon for my Patreon patrons. Yeah. Because every Monday, New Music Monday, 52 weeks a year, I generally put out 67 songs on average a year on my Patreon. So I posted this as New Music Monday this week, and I was like, here's why I wrote this. And then I went over to your website, and I copied your blurb. And then I saw that you had create and curate on there, and I was like, wow, I used those same words, create and curate. And I liked it because create and curate, first they rhyme, they scan, they're two syllables each. They're the emphasis, create, curate, it's the same scansion on both words. But also, so you're creating an internal rhyme and not the expectation that the end of every line is going to rhyme, which is, I try not to be too beholden to tradition ever. And I love internal rhymes. But also, curate, I put a lot of emphasis on the creators, music, performers, painters, poets. I mentioned these directly, and I'm leaving out 100,000 creatives.
Yeah.
Performers encapsulate so many, but it's still not enough. I mean, I don't think. But without that word curate, you ignore all of the people who are involved in an art scene who don't directly practice the creation of art themselves.
Right.
And there are tons of them.
Yes.
The volunteers, the organizers, the people who understand how vital an art scene is, but maybe don't want to directly participate on an art from an art standpoint. Mm-hmm. Or even if they do, they still tackle the work that makes it possible to present art to communities, to make sure that artists have an audience in the community, make sure the art that's presented is art that the community is able to find itself reflected in, or more importantly, appropriately challenge the community to think, because that's important as well, but not overly so always. I mean, sometimes art can be so challenging that the message gets lost because it becomes controversial and people have conflicted feelings, and that's a whole different thing. But it's the volunteers and the people who make these shows, these displays, the performances, all of this happen. I felt like without that word curate, I was giving them such short shrift and ignoring their existence. So I think that might be the most important word in the song.
I love it. I love it. Well, without further ado, let's listen to the Pop of Culture theme song written by Mikey Mason. It's the heartbeat of our teams that calls up the people as they create and curate the works that touch their souls. The music performers, the painters, the poets. I have to admit that the very last line that has been playing in my head nonstop.
That's the point. That's the hook.
That's exactly what you want, right?
When I wrote it, I was going to have that be the first and last line, but I didn't want to give it away. I didn't want to telegraph it. I like that dun dun dun, and then started on the music. So, you just kind of, ride into it, ride up the hill and then start coasting down. But yeah, you write a hook so it sticks that's what you do. That's the point of a hook. That's why it's called that.
That's exactly. What was the response from your Patreon peeps?
They enjoyed it. The most common response, because they're intellectual, smart Alex. I said, using my radio friendly vocabulary, was, "I feel the pop."
Of culture. Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Mikey, thank you again for doing this for us. Really, really appreciate it. Thanks for coming in to tell us about the process.
You're totally welcome. Thank you.
Hey, Kara.
Hello.
It's time to talk about all the awesome things going on in and around our listening area. Are you ready?
I'm ready for some good times.
Yep. Muncie's branch of the American Association of University Women is having its annual used book sale Saturday, May 25th to Saturday, June 4th. The sale will be closed Sunday and Monday, May 26th and 27th for the Memorial Day holiday. The hours are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, May 25th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, May 28th through the 31st, and 10 a.m. to noon Saturday, June 1st. Proceeds from the sale benefit the Muncie branch of the AAUW. The Muncie branch uses its proceeds to support its non-traditional student scholarships and the operations of the organization.
That sounds pretty great.
I always get so many books. Yeah, on the last day, on the very last day of the sale, you can fill a bag for like $5.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's a good deal.
The Farmland Fire Department Street Fair is offering carnival rides and games, live music, and of course, fabulous fair food. Friday and Saturday, May 24th and 25th.
You had me at fair food. Sounds delicious. Cat's Crystals in downtown Muncie is hosting an art club on the last Thursday of every month. This month, on May 30th, they are making mini sketchbooks from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Cat's Crystals is at 111 East Adams Street.
Okay, an art club. I'm in.
I know, right? Doesn't that sound cool?
It sounds
and
like
it's
a
like
lot
after
of fun.
It's kind of an after hours thing, a laid back artsy vibe, and they invite all creators and people who just love art and love the art community to attend. I think that's a great idea.
Yes, you can make art with other folks.
Yes.
The exhibition Winding a Cord will be on view in Indianapolis May 31st through June 30th at Companion, 3715 Washington Boulevard. The exhibition of works in painting, collage, ceramics, textiles, and printmaking features six contemporary Indiana-based artists presented together for the very first time, curated by Brady Euless of Companion and presented in partnership with Gang Gang. More information at thisiscompanion.com.
And don't forget, race fans, there's that big event this week. Well, you know, I don't have to tell you. If you have an event you want listeners to know about, tell us about it at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
And there's the checkered flag. We've made it to the end of another show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, whose mind is always racing.
Yeah. Special thanks this week to Phil Hoffman and Tracy Lauk. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio on the campus of Ball State University.